He kind of started all the plants growing, and he started people. Well, I guess he's kind of big and fat.
He can see us whatever we do. Whatever we do, he has such powerful eyes. He doesn't have millions and thousands and billions. And he can still see us when we're bad.
He could be sitting on the table right now, but you can't see him.
He can't be everywhere at once doing everything for everybody. Everybody can't get what they want.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, this morning to Operation Restore Christian America. My name is David Stobenel. My website is genuinechristianitynow.com, and I encourage each and every one of you to visit there as often as you can find time to do so, because articles are posted throughout the week that are very significant and very timely articles, many of them breaking news that is ahead of the other people that claim to be breaking news. And another reason is that information that is discussed on this broadcast, the information is directed on, reinforces and supports the material that is discussed on air. Now, the call-in number here is 608-433-9306, and this is a live broadcast from 9 to 10 a.m. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. I always begin with at least a couple of verses from the Holy Scriptures, and this day they will be from the New Testament in the book of 1 John 3. And to begin with, 1 John 3, chapter 2, verse 23. Whosoever denieth the Son, the same hath not the Father. But he that acknowledges the Son hath the Father also. And just for a slight digression before I move on to the next very, very significant and profound verse, do you know that Jews acknowledge the Son, and that Muslims acknowledge the Son? They do it differently than Christians, and not to the extent that the Savior requires and deserves in terms of what he deserves for his perfect sacrifice. For example, Jews in their writings, within voluminous writings called the Talmud, acknowledge the Son, but they do it in a very negative way. But nevertheless, they do not deny his existence. But if they are called, if some of the leading rabbis are questioned and called out about their derogatory comments that are in writing in their Talmud, they attempt to explain away that it's another man named Jesus. I thought that was pretty significant to mention before I moved on to 1 John chapter 3, verse 4. Whosoever committeth sin transgresses also the law, for sin is the transgression of the law. Now, that's the end of the scripture reading. Now, commenting on that verse, this, it's very important for every student, every young person, every Jew, every Muslim, everyone to understand that this is the New Testament. This is the guidebook for people that believe wholeheartedly, not half-heartedly or partly, or people that are in the God business or something to this effect, but that are totally committed to pursuit of the truth. This is a foundational verse for how we are to yet live. And So if there is, let's just say, someone that is disgusted with everything to do with Christians and Christianity, that you could say is an anti-Christian bigot. Well, that an atheistic anti-Christian bigot, or a Christian hater would be a better word to use in this context. Obviously, that verse would only have the effect of calling that person's attention to their lawless behavior under the secular humanist laws, because that person, male or female, man or woman, would not consider this as a guidebook for their behavior. So the putting things into context and being very, very careful about understanding better who denies the Son and who does not. And I acknowledge the Son. Jesus Christ is Lord. So this is part 6, and the title of this particular day is John Quincy Adams, Letters on Freemasonry. This is a book that I purchased, and it can be purchased and should be purchased and in everyone's library from Rivercrest Publishing over in Austin, suburb of Austin, Texas. It can be purchased, and it's not very expensive. And it's a series of letters after the murder of Captain William Morgan. John Quincy Adams had written exchanges with the leading lights of the day that were political leaders and religious leaders that were also known Freemasons. And so this is something that every single young and old alike American should get a copy of and read, because this is history that is so important and so unique to our country, in that it was not only an appalling event that took place when Captain William Morgan, a Freemason, was abducted, tortured for several days, then murdered by fellow Freemasons. So this exchange of letters that is available now, and I'm not making a single penny from what I'm saying when I'm trying to convince people to get it. Republican. Garrett has copies there. I called him and asked him personally if they were available, and he said, yes, there are copies available. It is a very important thing to determine whether we are to insist as a people, as the American people, to insist that Freemasonry be extinguished from our land, whether it is in fact a curse and has brought curse after curse after curse upon us, or if it is a blessing. And if it's somewhere in between, then it's how much poison do you want in your glass of water? I want none in mine, and I deserve no poison in my water, just like you do as well. Anyway, this is the 6th part of this series, and the other 5 parts are in the archives that can be easily located on my website, genuinechristianitynow.com, for your study time in listening to the past broadcasts. And this will be the final letter that I read today. And as I said, as a point that I was going to make toward the end of the day, this hour today, I'll be saying something about Billy the Kid and the interactions about Freemasonry and his being killed. Anyway, this is a letter to Edward Ingersoll, Esquire, and this is read directly from John Quincy Adams' Letters on Freemasonry, which I ordered from Rivercrest Publishing. Quincy, 23 September, 1831. This is John Quincy Adams writing to Edward Ingersoll. Dear sir, from the nature of the Masonic oaths, penalties, and secrets, and the construction given to them, not a forced and unnatural one, but conformable to the plain import of their terms by multitudes of Masons in the western part of New York, the crimes immediately connected with the murder of William Morgan were committed. I charge them, therefore, upon the institution. And if Masonry had been until then a perfectly innocent and even useful institution, from the time of the commission of those crimes, it would have ceased to be so. From that time, the community acquired the right of calling upon the fraternity to discontinue and renounce at least the administration of oaths, the imposition of all forms of penalties, and all secrets whatever. A large and increasing portion of the community have made this demand, a demand just and reasonable in itself, and the more so as the oaths, penalties, and secrets have been divulged not only by Morgan's book, but by the concurring testimony of numerous seceding Masons. The oaths, the penalties, and the secrets, whether all disclosed with perfect accuracy or not, whether understood as they were by the murderers of Morgan, or as explained by the defenders of Masonry, are unreasonable, odious, and I believe unlawful. The oaths of all Masons heretofore admitted, if they ever had any binding force, are dissolved by the fact of the public disclosure of the secrets which they had bound themselves to keep. Their country calls upon them to disclaim henceforth and forever all secrets, and as incidental to the injunction of them, all oaths and penalties. This reasonable and moderate call has not only been resisted by the great body of Freemasons throughout the United States, but no man, high or low, eminent or obscure, has dared to avow this opinion and unite in this call without being assailed in his reputation, robbed of his good name, insulted, abused, and vilified openly and in secret by individual Masons and by organized lodges, a body of at least 200,000 men scattered over the whole Union, all active and voting men, linked together by secret ties for purposes of indefinite extent, bound together by oaths and penalties, operating with terrific energy upon the imagination of the human heart and upon its fears, embracing within the penalty of its laws the President of the United States and his leading competitors, and winding itself round every great political party for support, like poisonous ivy round a sturdy oak, and round every object of its aversion, like the boa constrictor round its victim. Such, in faint and deluded colors, is at this time the image of the Masonic institution in these United States, commanding despotically a large portion of the public presses, intimidating by its terrors multitudes of others, and amidst all its internal dissensions, uniting with the whole mass of its power against every common adversary, one of the most alarming and pernicious characters in which it now presents itself is that of its political dominion. You tell me that you are anti-Masonic in your opinions and feelings, but are perplexed by the mixture of politics with anti-Masonry. But you place herein the effect before the cause. The mixture of politics is with Masonry. It is the misfortune of Mr. Clay to be entangled with Masonry, and I sincerely regret that he has not felt it his duty, as I think it was, to shake off his shackles. His motives, I have no doubt, were generous, but the effect is that he sustains and identifies himself with the Masonic cause. That cause is now sustained only by such artificial and unnatural pillars. Neither Mr. Clay nor you, forgive me for saying, estimate at its true value the cause of anti-Masonry. You look chiefly to the motives of its supporters and distrust them too much. You ask if Masonry should be made answerable for the crimes of a few individual Masons. Should the royal government of Rome have been abolished for the violence committed upon a single woman? Should the Decemvirate have been subverted for the murder of Virginia by her own father? Should the tribe of Benjamin have been exterminated for the brutal abuse of one Levite's concubine? Should the British nation have gone to war with Spain for the cutting off by a few Spaniards of one smuggler's ears? In all those cases, and in numberless others, which swarm in human history, the connection between the crime and the institution made answerable for it was infinitely more remote than the cluster of Morgan murder crimes is from the vitals of Masonry. But I have spoken only of the crimes committed at the time. Look at the government of the state of New York, struggling in vain from that time to this, 5 long years, to bring the perpetrators of the murder to punishment. See judges, sheriffs, witnesses, jurors, entangled in the net of Masonry, and justice prostrated in her own temple by the touch of her invisible hand. Several of the abductors have indeed been convicted, and among them one sheriff of a county, 3 or 4 upon their own confession of guilt. You say you have been told by men who care much more for truth than for masonry that there is no reason to believe that any Mason has refused to give testimony on account of Masonic obligations. My dear sir, go to the records of the courts. You will find witnesses refusing to testify upon the express ground of Masonic obligations, avowing that they consider those obligations paramount to the laws of the land. You will see them contumacious to the decisions of the court, fined and imprisoned for contempt, suffer the punishment rather than bear the testimony, and instead of expulsion, be refunded, at least in part, for their fines by contributions from the lodges. I give you names: Isaac Allen, Eli Bruce, Ezekiel Jewett, John Whitney, Erasmus Turner, Erastus Day, Sylvanus Cohn, Elisha M. Forbes, Benjamin Enos. You will find much more. You will find Masonic grand and petit juries, summoned by Masonic sheriffs, eager to sit upon the trials, perverting truth and justice when admitted on the array and often excluded upon challenge to the favor. And last of all, you will find one of the men most deeply implicated in the murder screened from conviction by one Mason upon his jury. That this enormous train of abuses should be sustained by those who have it in abhorrence, and that every individual denouncing it should be hunted down as if he himself were a pest to society because Masonry has fastened itself to the skirts both of General Jackson and Mr. Clay, to sink or swim with them is itself one of the most objectionable properties of the institution. Clay Masonry has become not only the familiar denomination of a great political party, but of a party which, to put down a high, pure, and virtuous manifestation of popular sensibility, takes to its bosom Jacksonism itself. So it was in all the New York elections of last November. So it has been in the elections of the last Massachusetts legislature. Clay Masons gave New York to the Regency to put down the anti-Mason Granger. Clay Masons made a Jackson man a senator for our county of Plymouth over a national Republican with 300 more popular votes, because forsooth he was the anti-Masonic and his competitor the Masonic candidate. And yet I hear Masons complain of proscription and disenfranchisement. I may perhaps publish part of these letters, but without at all implicating you. Show them, if you please, to Mr. Walsh, as the moonstruck visions of your friend, John Quincy Adams. That's the end of that particular letter, and that's the last letter I'm reading from John Quincy Adams' Letters on Freemasonry. The rest is up to you, ladies and gentlemen. start to know your history and learn your history, and not only that, to teach it to your children and your grandchildren that are old enough now to begin learning things that are of a serious nature, and of course protect the tender ears of the younger children until the day that they are old enough. Some of us have grandchildren, such as myself, have grandchildren that are now in college and already in the workforce. Anyway, they need to know things that they did not learn in the now very, very seriously compromised school system in this country. Like, for example, if you were to ask one of your children that's in his 20s or 30s, what is Mr. Clay's first name, after what I just read there, would he be able to spontaneously answer, or would he have to get on his iPad and look it up? It's just a question I'm asking as to how much of an effort you've made so far and how far distant your grandchildren are from you as the effort to separate the different generations within a family from one another by very designing people that want more power over you and over your family and over your privacy and over your intelligence. Now, I'm moving along now, but this is an open line for today, 608-433-9306. I welcome you to call in with any comments that you care to make about Freemasons, Freemasonry. Freemasons obviously are welcome to call in so that I can attempt to convince them to look more deeply into what they are involved with, and in hopes that they will repent from that particular activity as the result of learning about this vicious criminal activity that is a part of the immediate history of the institution itself and members of it inside America in the past. Now, I'm going to now bring something else to your attention for just a few minutes here, maybe 5 to 10 minutes. And this is a series of information that was written over a long period of time, about 1,000 papers worth. And this is just a part of it. It's called A Skeleton Key to the Gemstone Files. May 1st, 1975. This is another part of our history. These were allegedly written by Bruce Porter Roberts, who was in the company. He was in the CIA, which we would all be doing better without the CIA from its inception. That's another subject matter for another day, but that's just a snapshot profile of this man who is one of the good guys. Skeleton Key to the Gemstone Files, May 1st, 1975. The Gemstone File was written in many segments over a period of years by an American man named Bruce Roberts. Parts of the file were released to certain Americans beginning in 1969. The number of handwritten pages is well over 1,000, and of which I have read about 400. I do not have the time of the research facilities to verify the entire story. Perhaps others can help. As a digression for a moment, this is going to be posted on genuinechristianitynow.com. For your investigation purposes, this is for completely mature adult Christian men only. There is coarse language in here, so pray about it before you read it, because it's very disturbing information as you get deeply within this. Since the scope of the work is so large and the events described so complex and interlocking, it may be more easily understood with this skeleton outline of the Gemstone thesis. Individual papers can then be read with greater comprehension. 1932. Onassis, a Greek drug pusher and ship owner who made his first million selling Turkish tobacco, opium, in Argentina, worked out a profitable deal with Joseph Kennedy, Eugene Meyer, and Meyer Lansky. Onassis was to ship booze directly into Boston for Joseph Kennedy. Also involved was a heroin deal with Franklin and Elliot Roosevelt, 1934. Onassis, Rockefeller, and the Seven Sisters, major oil companies, in parentheses, signed an agreement, outlined an oil cartel memo. Beat the Arabs out of their oil, ship it on Onassis ships, Rockefeller and the Seven Sisters to get rich. All this was done. Roberts, studying journalism and physics at the University of Wisconsin, learned these things via personal contacts. His special interest was in crystallography and the creation of synthetic rubies, the original gemstone experiment. 1936 to 1940, Eugene Meyer buys the Washington Post to get our news media. Other mafia buy other papers, broadcasting, TV, etc. News censorship of all major news goes into effect. 1941 to 1945. World War II. Very profitable for Onassis, Rockefeller, Kennedy's, Roosevelt, I.G. Farben, etc. Onassis selling oil, arms, and dope to both sides went through the war without losing a single ship or man. That doesn't sound plausible to me. As a digression, that doesn't sound plausible to me, but I haven't researched that deeply yet. 1949, Onassis buys U.S. surplus Liberty ships in questionable illegal purchase. Lawyer Burke Marshall helps him. 1956, Howard Hughes, Texas millionaire, is meanwhile buying his way toward his own personal gain. He buys senators, governors, etc. He finally buys his last politician, newly elected Vice President Nixon, via a $250,000 non-repayable loan to Nixon's brother, Donald. Early 1957, Vice President Nixon repays the favor by having IRS Treasury grants, tax-free status, refused twice before to Hughes Medical Foundation, sole owner of Hughes Aircraft, creating a tax-free, non-accountable money funnel or laundry for whatever Hughes wanted to do. U.S. government also shelved antitrust suits against Hughes, TWA, etc. Now, for a slight digression about this, there were two different feminists, obviously, but Hughes women that were involved with the investigation that Edwin Crosby III was participating. Actually, he was the principal in initiating the litigation. Anyway, he named an Ann Hughes, and the other name of the other Hughes woman was, I forget at the moment, but that's contained within the interview that Fred Smart gave to Edwin Crosby III over in Chicago several years ago. It's titled Fred Smart - Injustice Exposed. And for those of you that are researchers and students that want to learn the truth, that is posted in the archives at my website. It's not difficult to find. Fred Smart - Injustice Exposed at genuinechristianitynow.com is the website. March 1957, Onassis carried out a carefully planned event. He has Hughes kidnapped from his bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel using Hughes' own men, Chester Davis, born Cesar in Sicily et al. Hughes' men either quit, get fired, or stay on in the new Onassis organization. A few days later, Mayor Cannon of Nevada, now Senator Cannon, arranges a fake marriage to Jean Peters to explain Hughes, battered and brain damaged in the scuffle, is taken to the Emerald Isle Hotel in the Bahamas, where the entire top floor has been rented for 30 days, and later dragged off to a cell on Onassis Island, Scorpios. Onassis now has a much larger power base in the U.S., the Hughes Empire, as well as control over Vice President Nixon and other Hughes-purchased politicians. L. Wayne Rector, Hughes' double since 1955, becomes Hughes. September 1957. Onassis calls the Appalachian meeting to announce to U.S. Mafia head his grab of Hughes and his adoption of Hughes' game plan for acquiring power, buying U.S. senators, congressmen, governors, judges to take control legally of the U.S. government. Onassis' radio message to Appalachia from a remote Pennsylvania farmhouse intercepted reluctantly by FBI's J. Edgar Hoover on the basis of a tip-off from some Army intelligence guys who weren't in on the plan. Incidentally, the word legally, you don't notice the word constitutionally anywhere near that word. I digress. Also in 1957, Joseph Kennedy takes John F. and Jackie to see Onassis on his yacht, introduces John, and reminds Onassis of an old mafia promise. The presidency for a Kennedy. Onassis agrees. 1958. Hordes of mafia-selected, purchased and supported quote-unquote grassroots candidates sweep into office. 1959, Castro takes over Cuba from dictator Batista, thereby destroying cozy and lucrative mafia gambling empire run for Onassis by Meyer Lansky. Castro scoops up $6 million in mafia casino receipts. Onassis is furious. Vice President Nixon becomes operations chief for CIA planned Bay of Pigs invasion, using CIA, Hunt, McCord, etc., and Cuban ex-Batista strong-arm cops, parenthesis, Cuban freedom fighters, Martinez, Gonzalez, etc., as well as winners like Frank Sturgis, parenthesis, Fiorini, 1959, stirring election battle between Kennedy and Nixon. Either way, Onassis wins, since he has control over both candidates. 1960, JFK elected. American people happy. Rose Kennedy, happy. Onassis, happy. Mafia, ecstatic. Roberts brings his synthetic rubies, the original gemstones, to Hughes Aircraft in Los Angeles. They steal his rubies, the basis for laser beam research, laser bombs, etc., because of the optical quality of the rubies. One of the 11 possible sources for one of the ingredients involved in the gemstone experiment was the Golden Triangle area. Roberts was married to the daughter of the former French consul in Indochina. In that area, Onassis' involvement in the Golden Triangle dope trade was no secret. Roberts' investigation revealed the Onassis-Hughes connection, kidnap, and switch. Gemstones, synthetic rubies and sapphires with accomplished histories. Gemstone papers were sold or given away to consul offices in return for information. A worldwide information network was gradually developed, a trade of the intelligence activities of many countries. This intelligence network is the source for much of the information in the gemstone file. I digress for a moment to mention once again the call-in number is 608-433-9306. You are definitely welcome to call in and discuss the subject matters being discussed today. Or if you have something heavy on your heart, I would obviously make an exception. Incidentally, the decorum is no slimy language, no sleazy language, no double entendres that are heavily larded with words and intended. This is a Christian man speaking, and this is a broadcast intended to lift everyone up out of the sewer. In other words, Operation Restore Christian America. January 1961. Joseph Kennedy has a stroke, ending his control over John and Bobby. The boys decide to rebel against Onassis' control. Why? Intermafia struggle? Perhaps a dim hope of restoring this country to its mythical integrity? They began committing mafia no-nos. Arrested Wally Bird, owner of Air Thailand, who had been shipping Onassis heroin out of the Golden Triangle, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, under contract with the CIA, Air Opium in parentheses. Really, it's titled Air America. Absolutely disgusting name for a smuggling operation. Arrested Teamster Mafia Jimmy Hoffa and put him in jail. Declared the $73 million in forged Hughes land liens deposited with San Francisco Bank of America as security for the TWA judgment against Hughes to be what they are, forgeries. April 1961, CIA Bay of Pigs fiasco. Hunt, McCord, CIA, Batista's Cubans, and Mafia, angry about JFK's lack of enthusiasm. Mafia, Onassis has his right-hand man, Hughes' top aide, former FBI and CIA Robert Mayhew, nicknamed IBM for Iron Bob Mayhew, hire and train a Mafia assassin team to get Castro. The team of a dozen or so includes John Rosselli and Jimmy the Weasel Pradiano, the expert Mafia hitmen, assisted by CIA Hunt and McCord and others. This was report, and this is a 1975 writing. This was reported recently by Jack Anderson, who gets a lot of his tips from his friend, Frank Fiorini Sturgis, also on the Castro assassination team. The team tries five times to kill Castro with everything from long-range rifles to apple pie with sodium morphate in it. Castro survives. 1963. Members of the Castro assassination team arrested at Lake Pontchartrain, Louisiana, by Bobby Kennedy's Justice Boys. Angered, Onassis stops trying to kill Castro. He changes target and goes for the head. JFK, who, according to Onassis, welched on a Mafia deal. JFK sets up Group of 40 to fight Onassis. August 1963, two murders had to occur before the murder of JFK, or people who would understand the situation and might squawk. Senator Estes Kefauver, whose crimes commission, this is important now. He was from Tennessee, a senator from Tennessee. Senator Estes Kefauver, whose crimes commission investigations had uncovered the 1932 deal between Onassis, Kennedy, Eugene Meyer, Lansky, Roosevelt et al., and that's quite a blending of names, a Greek, a Catholic, Irishman. Eugene Meyer, I think, is Jewish. Meyer Lansky, is Jewish. Roosevelt has been many that he was blending. It wasn't the Jews. It was the Mafia. It was whoever was into criminal activity. Anyway, Kefauver planned a speech on the Senate floor denouncing Mafia operations. Instead, he ate a piece of apple pie laced with sodium morphate, used in rat poison, and had a sodium morphate-induced heart attack on the Senate floor. Now, a lengthy digression is necessary here now from some things that I discovered both in the past and just recently. One of the things that I haven't paid for the licensing yet to be able to play in its entirety, so I'm not going to play it at all, but I'm going to say where I discovered something that is either an extraordinary amount of what is called gaslighting of the American people. And obviously for younger people that are listening would know the term gaslighting well. Researchers would know the term gaslighting well. The enemy that is trying to confuse all the Americans into submission under their satanic British Israel world Freemasonry dictatorship, their globalist dictatorship, would know the term well. But younger people should learn that what the term gaslighting means, which essentially means using a situation to say things that are untrue, that sound very practical and logical, but are absolutely absurd, that you will believe simply as a result of who's delivering the material into your mind. The Freemasons call it hoodwinking. Anyway, there's a song that Tom T. Hall wrote, and in his later years, he sung it to a small audience, not an entirely five or six people, but a small audience, and it's posted on YouTube, and it's titled, it's at a website called Music City Roots, and it's titled Tom T. Hall, Old Dogs, Children, and Watermelon Wine, and it's posted 11 years ago, and it has 10 million views. And in that, he describes how after the chaotic Democrat convention where all the hippies disrupted everything, that 4 years later the Democrat convention was held in Miami, and that Estes Kefauver was nominated to campaign for the presidency. Well, Tom T. Hall might be totally innocent because he was already up in the years at the time, or he might be a Freemason that's heavily involved. I haven't looked into his life that seriously, but I absolutely just really appreciate several of the songs that he has written and sung. But he claimed in that brief speech before he sung that song that Estes Kefauver was nominated for the presidency. And this would have been in 1972, which was approximately, it was several years after Estes Kefauver was dead, about 9 or 10 years or something like that after he was dead. So this is a gaslighting, whether it was intended by Tom T. Hall or not. And I wanted to mention that in detail, because this is, if there is any example of a study of gaslighting, listen to that song, look up, just type and research the name Senator Estes Kefauver, and you will discover that what I'm saying there is an important teaching lesson for your children and your grandchildren and your friends and your enemies, because your enemies are partly your enemies because they don't know what they're thinking or doing or talking about anymore, because they are just as deceived as everyone else that gets gaslighted, gets hoodwinked by these nefarious people called Freemasons. The truth will set you free, not Freemasons. Anyway, to continue for a few minutes more, Philip Graham, editor of the Washington Post, another one of the mafia members here, apparently, or allegedly, I should say. Philip had married Catherine Meyer, Eugene Meyer's daughter, who had inherited the Washington Post and allied media empire. Graham put together the Kennedy-Johnson ticket and was Kennedy's friend in the struggle with Onassis. I stand corrected. Philip Graham was apparently trying to do what was right and good. According to Gemstone, Catherine Meyer Graham bribed some psychiatrists to certify that Phil was insane. And there's your medical mafia stepping in, and Hughes, that I mentioned earlier, you know, had grabbing that handle. He was not the real Howard Hughes, but the stand-in mafia man. He was allowed out of the nut house for the weekend and died of a shotgun wound in the head in the Graham home in Washington. Death ruled suicide. November 1st, 1963. The hit on JFK was supposed to take place in true mafia style, a triple execution together with Diem and Nhu in Vietnam. Diem and Nhu, now these were other Catholics, obviously, got theirs as scheduled. Onassis had invited Jackie for a cruise on the Christina, where she was when JFK got tipped off that Big O planned to wipe him out. JFK called Jackie on the yacht, got tipped on the yacht from the White House, hysterical. Get off that yacht if you have to swim, and canceled his appearance at a football stadium in Chicago where this CIA mafia assassin team was poised for the kill. Jackie stayed on board, descended the gangplank a few days later on Onassis' arm in Turkey to impress the Bey, Mustafa. Madame New in the U.S. bitterly remarked, "Whatever has happened in Vietnam." One of the assassination teams was picked up in Chicago with a rifle and quickly released by the police. 3 weeks later, the mafia's alternate and carefully arranged execution plan went into effect. JFK was assassinated in Dallas. A witness who recognized pictures of some of the people arrested in Dealey Plaza as having been in Chicago 3 weeks earlier told Black Panthers Hampton and Clark the JFK murder. Onassis Hughes man Robert Mayhew, Onassis and Hughes man Robert Mayhew reassigned the Mafia CIA Castro assassination team to the murder of JFK, adding Eugene Brading, a third Mafia hitman from the Denver Mafia Amaldonas family. 2 months earlier, Brading on parole after a series of crimes, applied for a new driver's license, explaining to the California DMV that he had decided to change his name to Jim Brading. Brading got his California parole for the first time to look things over, and the second time when JFK was scheduled for his Dallas trip. Lee Harvey Oswald, CIA, with carefully planned links to both the ultra-right and to the communist, was designated as the patsy. He was supposed to shoot Governor Colony, and he did. Of the four, Oswald, Brading, Fratiano, and Roselli had a timer and a backup man. Backup and the police. Pick up. Fence.